At last night's Democratic debate in Las Vegas, candidates did touch on climate change, but was it enough? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
Vice President Biden, you have said that you want to hold oil and gas executives accountable for their role in harming our planet.
Telemundo's Vanessa Hawke was one of the moderators at last night's debate. She was there to make sure the issue got its due. She's convinced it did. Also, we spoke with the new dean of the Chaplain School of Hospitality and Tourism Management at Florida International University ahead of this week's South Beach Wine and Food Festival. He'll share with us how the hospitality industry is about to change dramatically in the coming years. Finally, Boricuan singer Ile pays homage to old-school Puerto Rican sounds mixed with the anger of protest. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Last night, the Democratic presidential candidates squared off in another debate, this time in Las Vegas, ahead of the Nevada caucuses, which is on Saturday. There were a number of high-tension moments between the candidates and the moderators, and one of those points came from Telemundo reporter Vanessa Hawke, posing a question to Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar.
You're running on your Washington experience, but last week in a Telemundo interview, you could not name the president of Mexico or discuss any of his policies. Last night, you defended yourself saying, quote, this is in jeopardy. But my question to you is, shouldn't our next president know more about one of our largest trading partners?
Of course. Of course. And I don't think that that momentary forgetfulness actually reflects what I know about Mexico and how much I care about it.
That tape is from NBC News. Hawke is an Emmy Award-winning reporter with Telemundo. She's based in Miami and has focused her career reporting on the environment. She made history last night, becoming the first environmental reporter to be a moderator in a presidential debate. Now, we spoke with Hawke earlier today and began with her first question from the debate about U.S.-Mexico relations.
Well, you know, Luis, this was a question about policy. This was an interview that she did with one of my colleagues at Telemundo last week. And he asked her if she could tell us anything about the policy of the Mexican president. And she could not. And then he continued to ask him for the name. And she could not mention the name of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. So, that is not what is important. I think it was just important to highlight that the next president of the United States have to see how critical Mexico is for everything. I mean, Mexico is one of our top trading partners. Everything that happened at the border in Mexico is going to affect the United States profoundly. I mean, economically, about migration, every single aspect. So it was important for us just to highlight that the next president of the United States have to see Mexico as an ally.
It took an hour before getting to the issue of climate change. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, how high is the issue of climate change for Democratic voters? How important is it?
It's very, very important. And in this election, it's going to be very important. A couple of days ago, I got the results of a Pew Research Center poll that says that for the first time, environmental protection is as important as the economy, as top priorities for voters. And this is they have been doing this type of poll for two decades, and for the first time, environmental protection is as important. And if you go to state by state, for example, in the Iowa caucus, in the New Hampshire election, it was the number two priority for voters. And here in Nevada, what they are saying is that most possibly it's going to be the number one priority in Nevada and in California. And I think it has to do with the fact that here we have a very diverse population. 30% of the population of Nevada is Latino. And when you talk about minorities, we are disproportionately affected by the impacts of climate change. So when they go to the polls, they are definitely going to have in mind what are the proposals of each candidate to deal with this crisis.
Now, as you're sitting there listening to their answers, all the candidates speaking on their view of this issue of climate change and global warming, what was your impression of how serious they take it? But, you know, what are their plans?
Well, I'm happy to say that I see that in all the democratic field, they take it very seriously. They understand that this is an existential crisis, that that we are going through a climate emergency, and that we need to tackle this head on, and that the next president of the United States is going to have a great responsibility in his shoulders or in her shoulders, because as scientists have told us, we have 10 years to turn our economy around, and this is going to be a monumental task. We're going to have to change a lot of things in the way that we live, in the way that we consume energy. We have to move away from fossil fuels to renewable energy. So this is going to take a lot from every single aspect of society, starting by politicians, because they are going to be the ones, at the end of the day, that are going to be able to create policy, to create laws that are going to make it easier for us, the citizens, to live in a sustainable way.
You know how politicians can be during debates. They want to stick to their talking points. Sometimes they will not answer the question. It was very interesting last night. You were pressing some of them, specifically Vice President Joe Biden. You were pressing him on holding companies accountable for violating environmental regulations.
Vice President Biden, you didn't answer to my questions.
I thought I did.
What would you do with these companies that are responsible for the destruction of our planet?
Why is it critical for you to ensure the voters get the full answer?
This is so important. You know, I think that right now we have a clear understanding of what is happening to our planet. I mean, scientists have been talking about this for decades, but I think right now everybody understands that our planet is changing, and we see it every single day. So this is about accountability. There are companies, especially the fossil fuel industries, of course, that have damaged our planet in an irreversible way. And they knew about this for decades, and they just continue business as usual, and they didn't do anything about it. So I think it's very important for our audience to understand that there is a responsibility here, and that politicians have to take that responsibility to hold them accountable.
You've been working, you know, as a reporter and journalist in English and Spanish. What is your take on the attitudes that the Latinx communities have on the issue of climate change compared to non-Hispanic voters?
Well, for the Latinx community, this is a very, very important issue. It's very personal. And there is two reasons. The first one is that we are disproportionately more affected by climate change. And just to bring into perspective, so just give you some numbers. Latino children are 40% more likely to die from asthma than children of any other ethnic group. Half of the Latino population in the United States lives in the 25 most polluted cities in the country. And then if you think about our countries of origins, many of our families don't have the possibility to rebuild when there is a storm, when there is a hurricane. We are being affected, for example, by droughts, in very, very serious droughts in Central America. And the people that live there don't have the possibility to move to another area of the country. Many of them, if they lose their crops, they just have to migrate, to leave everything behind, their families behind, their livelihoods, everything that they had, and go and look for a better life. So this is definitely very, very important. But on the other hand, I think that we, the Latino community, have a very special connection with our planet. I mean, if you think about it, it was just one or two generations ago that our parents or our grandparents used to work with the land directly. So I think it's in our DNA, this connection that we have with the planet. And I know, because I have been working not only as a journalist, but also in a nonprofit that I have that is called Sasha Mama, and around the country giving seminars and talking to Latinos and to students and to moms and to families about the importance of taking care of our planet. And I see the connection. I mean, once they know what is happening to our planet, they want to know, okay, how can I be part of the solution? What do I need to do? Why do I need to change in order to be an agent of change?
Vanessa, where did your passion for the environment start?
Very long time ago, actually. I am from Peru. I was born in Peru, so I am very close to the Amazon jungle and to nature, basically. So all my life, I grew up loving nature and with this great connection with the trees, with the ocean, with the animals. And as a journalist, my job is to tell the stories that are affecting my community. So many times it was politics, immigration, other times it was education. But over the past couple of years, I found myself more and more telling the story of the impacts of climate change. So I realized that this was the most important story of our times, a story that I needed to tell to my community.
I'm speaking with Telemundo's Vanessa Hawke. She was one of the moderators in last night's Democratic presidential debate in Las Vegas. Hawke is an Emmy Award-winning environment reporter, and you can find more coverage of last night's debate by going to WLRN.org. I think about last night's discussion, and again, you know, looking at it, they spent about 15 minutes talking about the issue of climate change. What I can say, having lived in Las Vegas, this is a city, and they did mention it, a city that is warming up very fast.
The fastest warming city.
Exactly. And also the fact that this is a city that has a very precarious relationship to water. Right next door to it is Lake Mead, which is what the water that feeds the city, and that lake is losing a lot of water very fast. Think back to Miami, the very first debates here, the very first Democratic debates. One of the things was, again, the criticisms. They didn't spend enough time talking about climate change. And this is Miami. Two cities in danger and not really spending a lot of time on the issue. What do you think about that?
Well, in this debate, I was reading the news this morning, and we spent more than 16 minutes talking about climate change. And I'm very happy because I think it was a robust discussion on climate change. We got all each one of the moderators to ask questions, and they were able the candidates were able to respond to very different issues. And I wish that we could have a whole debate about climate change because a lot to talk about, and it's very important that we understand exactly how these candidates are planning to tackle this crisis. But of course, there is a lot of more other issues that are very important too. So it was very difficult to fit them all in 2 hours. And besides that, you saw the candidates; they were really very. I mean, it was a very vivid debate. There was a lot of energy. They really wanted to shine each one of them for themselves and put up their plans and their platforms. So I'm very happy with the conversation that we have. As I told you, I mean, I wish we could have been talking more about climate change, but I think we did a good job.
As you know, South Florida is a minority region, a lot like Southern Nevada. And a lot of the people here, Latinx or Hispanic, we've seen firsthand that, and you were touching on this a moment ago, that climate change disproportionately affects people of color. Do you think this has been addressed enough, though, by
No.
the candidates?
No, but yesterday there was a mention of environmental justice, and we talked about it when we were meeting to discuss the questions that we were going to address to them. And definitely, this is something that is very important because it's been going on for years. The communities of colors and minorities are the most affected by climate change and the ones that have contributed to the problem the least. So it's really very sad to see or to think about the families that whose children get sick because of the place that they live, or because they grew up close to a fossil fuel industry plant. So really, it's something that we cannot tolerate. It's something that it should not exist and that we need to correct. So I am very happy that there is this awareness that is coming about this issue. And I think that we, the media, have to bring it up every time that we can. And we have to bring it up to the candidates and hold them accountable. What is your plan for this? How are you going to change this? And give me a specific plans. What exactly are you going to do? And that was exactly what we tried to do yesterday at the debate.
Nevada, being the third state, is unique in that, unlike Iowa and New Hampshire, now you're looking at a state with a very large minority population, again, especially Latino, Latinx community. When you look at how candidates speak to this community. You know, it's not just about climate change, but any of the issues. What's your biggest takeaway about how they think about, how they treat, how they speak to the Latino voter?
Well, definitely. I mean, you completely say it, very right. I mean, Nevada is the first, I would say, the first test for the candidates with the Latino community and with the minorities. Because, of course, Iowa and New Hampshire are states that don't represent the country, really. Nevada, 30% of the population of Nevada is Latino. So for the candidates, it is a test of fire to see if they are really connected with this community. They were listening and they were eager to hear their plans in immigration, in climate change, in the economy, in education, in health, in all the issues that are important for every resident of this country. I think what is important is to understand that this year, Latinos are expected for the first time to be the nation's largest racial minority in a U.S. presidential election. So we can definitely have a very powerful voice in this election and change the tides for one candidate or for the other.
I wanted to dig in a little bit, you know, into the work that you do, and especially, I mean, as a reporter, though, in trying to, again, tell this story, what is the biggest story that you want to tell about this issue, you know, for here, for, you know, the issue of climate change for here in South Florida?
Well, I think the story of climate change is global, of course, because it's affecting everybody on our planet, but it's very local. So when I work in Noticias del Mundo, I'm the leader of Planeta Tierra, and that is our environmental research unit. So what we try to do is show our viewers the issues that are going on our planet, how our planet is changing, and what are the consequences. But we frame it in the solutions. So when we look for the solutions, we were local. Even if it's this global issue, we focus on local solutions. So this gives our audience a sense of empowerment, that they can do something about it. When you talk about climate change, for many people, it could be overwhelming. It can be very scary. They can think, oh my God, I cannot do anything about it. But they have to understand that everybody can do something about it. And we, each one of us, with every decision that we take, every minute of our day, we are voting for our planet or not. So that's the way that we work at Noticias del Mundo, trying to create consciousness, empowering our community to act on climate.
What do you think about the leadership of South Florida and Florida in general in the way politicians have handled this topic?
Well, you know, I think this is such a critical issue, especially for Florida, for South Florida, for Miami. I mean, we are ground zero for the climate crisis, if you think about it. I mean, there is so much at risk in Miami. And unfortunately, I think that politicians have not given it the importance that it has. We need to start moving away from fossil fuels, and we need to start creating an economy that is sustainable very, very fast. I mean, 10 years ago, we should have started, or 20 years ago. So we don't have much time. We need to move forward. And this is what scientists are telling us. They have sounded all the alarms year after year, asking us to follow their recommendations. And I think it's time. And the wonderful news is that we have everything on the table. We have the technology, we have the resources, and we have the will of the people. We have seen this movement being energized by the youth, and they are just an amazing, powerful, unstoppable force. Last September, 6 million students went out to the streets to demand climate action from the government, to demand the possibility of a livable future. And we saw them that they are not taking no for an action. For an answer. So they are energizing this movement, and they have all the right to do it, because at the end of the day, is their planet, is the future.
Vanessa, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
That was Telemundo's Vanessa Hawk, one of the moderators of last night's Democratic presidential debate. The Nevada caucuses are this weekend. We'll be providing live coverage from NPR of the results beginning at 5 p.m. on Saturday. And you can find more details at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, is your hotel experience soon to become fully automated? We're going to learn about the new trends in hospitality coming up next on Sundial.
Vamos juntos a romper.
By the way, you're listening to Odio from the Puerto Rican singer Ile. Our conversation with her is coming up later in the program.
Sofoque para que ya no exista, para que nunca provoque que el odio se muera de hambre, porque nadie le da de comer. Vamos juntos a romper muros, barreras y alambres. Él como quiera convence.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Tourism and hospitality make up such a critical part of the South Florida economy. It was estimated in 2018, tourism contributed $18 billion to Miami-Dade County. And preliminary numbers from Broward and Palm Beach County in 2019 show that hotel occupancy rates continue to rise year after year. New technological innovations are changing the workforce in hospitality, and we could be seeing more and more automation in the years to come. We spoke to Michael Chang, the new dean of the FIU Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management, and graduate student Fabiana Gutierrez at the Chaplin School, and we discussed the South Beach Wine and Food Festival happening this week, which is put on by FIU.
Hospitality is the mecca in South Florida, especially in Miami. If you look at what's happening in Miami, not just from the food scene, which the South Beach Wine Food Festival is happening this weekend, but also from the entertainment scene. And then on top of that, you have the restaurants, you have the hotels, you have the cruise line industry, and you got this gorgeous weather in Miami that everybody wants to come to. So obviously, it's the hub of what makes South Florida and Miami breathe.
You focus a lot of your research and work and understanding the latest trends in food science and culinary arts, correct? Mm-hmm. So tell me about, you know, some of those trends and changes, some of the things that are happening right now.
What we see right now is a lot of clean labeling. There's a lot of emphasis on organic, healthy wellness, and then also foods that are better for you, foods that have added value. So they make you feel better when you eat them, the functional foods, we call them.
And what do you mean by clean labeling?
Clean labeling refers to ingredients that only have, foods that only have ingredients that are necessary for it, without the preservatives and the colors and the acidulants and all the other stuff that nobody understands.
How would you describe South Florida's, I guess, food scene and those trends compared to some of the other big American cities, New York, LA, things like that?
I would say it's up and coming. We've seen a lot more James Beard winners and awardees out of South Florida and Miami in particular. So, and we also see restaurateurs from the coast, New York and Los Angeles and also Chicago, opening up restaurants in Miami. So we see it's definitely up and coming for sure. And definitely I think the demographic in South Florida is also maturing in my opinion. And we're seeing a lot more requests for those kind of foods when they travel to different cities and they come back and say, I want that experience that I had in New York. Where can I find it?
Fabiana, for you growing up, I mean, you know, were you the one who was in the kitchen work, you know, with your parents or, you know, I mean, what role did food play for you? I wondered why this is so important in your life right now.
Ironically enough, I actually don't know how to cook, but I'm very passionate about food. I love going to eat. I love finding good places for food. I was kind of the sous chef at home with my parents. I was always trying to help with whatever I could, but I never actually cooked myself.
But the party planner, so that's
definitely
that's important. And Dean Chang, what about for you? Food, what role did it play as you were growing up?
I would say it's integral. So in my culture, I'm ethnic Chinese growing up in Malaysia. And in Malaysia, everybody's always eating. You know, we'll get done with breakfast and then we'll start thinking about what's for snack. And then that's before lunch. And then once we get done with lunch, we'll go down the road and we're like, okay, hey, that looks really good. Let's try that. And we'll like eat six times a day. You know, and then after we get done with dinner, we're hungry again at 10 o'clock. So it's integral.
Well, then you're in the right field.
Totally.
Dean Chang, you talked about how important tourism, but hospitality is to our economy here in South Florida. It generates so much money, but that money doesn't always trickle down, you know, to the worker. I mean, some people will profit very well, but you talk about the low-level food service workers, and many of them are campaigning for higher wages. When you look at the future of the industry, especially here in South Florida, is it sustainable the way that we have it right now?
Well, in my opinion, I think there's some cities, for instance, New York is one of them, where they have raised the minimum wage in order to try to address some of these challenges. In Miami, one of the challenges I see is our transportation system. We do not have a public transportation system, so we often hear stories of workers who are getting paid minimum wages and traveling 2 hours to go to work. And in my opinion, that is not sustainable. So where they're living is too far away from where they work. And in order for them to, I like to call it upskilling. So in order for them to progress upwards in their career, they need to obtain different skills and be better at so they can be promoted. So what I've been championing is, I say the industry really should get together. So for instance, the city of Miami Beach, there's so many hotels and restaurants down there. And when we have all these shift workers, what they could do is develop a program, and FIU will be in the right position to help them upskill the employees in between shifts. So somebody who's a banquet cook could go up to be a line cook at the restaurant within the same organization. But we really need the industry to band together and then let us help them develop those programs.
So the industry should connect with the schools, and again, just to offer those opportunities for
Correct.
People to advance themselves.
Correct.
Fabiana, are you considering, I mean, life here in South Florida after you finish, or do you think that, again, it's a challenging place to live. Do you think that maybe you'd have to go somewhere else, or you want to go somewhere else?
I will agree with you. It is a very challenging place to live, especially through my point of view. I'm graduating soon. I have to start looking at, you know, my future. I definitely do see a future here in South Florida. It's where I'm born, not born, but raised. It's where I've been here all my life. I have connections here. I build those relationships. And I think Miami is a huge place for tourism. And it just keeps growing every single day.
What makes this place so unique for a student like you and what you're trying to learn? Because, you know, I think about maybe some other hotspots, Orlando. I did mention L.A. There's Hawaii. There's, and, you know, go to the Caribbean. But what makes South Florida so unique in what you're trying to accomplish?
I mean, the scale of events that happen around here year-round, just the atmosphere that we're in, we're by the beach, it's one of those iconic places. There's nothing like Miami.
Yeah, Dean Chang, compared to other places, you know, a student can go to learn. The other one I was thinking of, too, of course, is, you know, Las Vegas, where I used to live there. But what makes this place so unique that you can get it all here?
I think it's our international gateway. I used to live in Minnesota. It was hard to get anywhere. So, I mean, you had to take two flights just to get someplace. And here is because we have two major airports. It's easy for us to travel around the country and outside of the country. So it makes it very appealing. And plus, it seems to me the entertainment industry seems to have its own life here that's 24/7. You know, we've seen Instagram feeds of celebrities and these constantly show up in Miami, you know, and they know someone, for instance, with David Grutman, and then they're hanging out at his restaurants or his nightclubs, and people just keep coming.
You know, I wanted to ask you about a key part of the program is working in the field, and my understanding is that a number of the students helped out during the Super Bowl, correct? Mm-hmm. I mean, what were they doing? What were some of the things they got to do?
There was two major things that our students were involved in. One was the event planning side of it. not so much the planning, but really the execution of the events. So they help at a bunch of different events that were happening at the Super Bowl. And then the second part was the food rescue. So there was a group of students who went around to the different events and collected the food, and then we recovered it basically for the mission, the Miami Rescue Mission.
I'm speaking with Dean Michael Chang, the new dean of the Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management at Florida International University. And also joining us is Fabiana Gutierrez, a graduate student in the Chaplin School. Now, this week is the South Beach Wine and Food Festival put on by FIU. And you can find more information and see photos on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I want to ask you about technology.
Sure.
You know, I want to know about the innovations in technology. We always keep hearing about how technology could push a lot of people out of work. You know, and I'm not just talking about robots. I'm just talking about, you know, you know, AI, but also just the fact that certain technologies eventually might be cheaper and then some workers will lose their jobs. What do you see is going to happen in the coming years and the next couple of decades that could impact workers in food systems, delivery systems, in hospitality, restaurants, and so forth? What do you see might happen?
What I think is going to happen is automation. So there's a lot of tasks that are repetitive. Those jobs will go away. They'll be replaced by robots. And then what's going to happen too is these workers who have been doing those jobs need a new skill set. And again, it goes back to my comment earlier, is how do we train them for a different set of skills?
And what kind of jobs do you see? A lot of them are repetitive. Which ones do you see will be replaced by automation?
So if we look at the lodging industry in the hotels, the front desk agent, I see that job changing. They no longer have to key in the customer, the guest. They don't have to check the credit cards, their IDs. All that could be done from the kiosk or from the app before the guest shows up at the hotel. What doesn't go away is the human interaction. So you still want to put one person instead of 10% behind the front desk to help out those who prefer to have the human interaction.
Are we talking about like the concierge?
Like semi-concierge / front desk.
Okay.
You have guests who wants that personalization, who wants the face-to-face contact, wants to talk to somebody upon check-in, and then you have guests like me who just check in on an app and get my key card and off to the room I go, and if I don't talk to anybody. So you have to meet both kind of demographics.
The reason I got you here is because the South Beach Wine and Food Festival. Fabiana, I'll start with you. What's your involvement in this?
So I am a volunteer recruitment coordinator. So I am in charge of acquiring students from different schools. We usually target FIU since all the proceeds of the festival go back to the Chaplin School of Hospitality. So I am just in charge of managing volunteers on site, making sure they're assigned to the correct events, making sure just their weekend is filled with events that they can work, they can see the behind the scenes, they can work during the event, post event. So I am just in charge of filling in all the spots throughout.
What's the hardest part? What's the most challenging part, do you think?
I think it's very difficult sometimes to kind of determine where a person fits and where they'll have a good experience. Because at the end of the day, we want the students to have a good time. We want them to want to come back the next year. So sometimes it's hard to place someone where they really aren't. They're not that match for it. So I think that's the most difficult part.
Yeah. I mean, Dean Chang, when you have an event like this, I mean, again, it's a huge event. What mostly do you want the students to walk away with?
I think the main thing for us is for them to experience the wide world of hospitality. So the Food and Wine Festival, actually, you know, the Wine and Food Festival is not just about wine and food and eating and drinking. It's really about logistics, there's leadership opportunities, opportunities for students to work ticketing, to practice their hospitality skills. So I want them to realize that it's not always about the production of wine or the creation of culinary gourmet food, but really there's a whole hospitality aspect to it and interacting with people. I would say it is the most successful wine and food festival in the country. To date, the festival in its 19th year has raised over $30 million for the school.
I want to hear from both of you on this one. Is, you know, when you have an event this big, again, it comes back to Fabiana, what you were saying, is all this planning that goes into it to make it work. And I'm wondering how much of it's planning and then how much of it is improvisation. You know, it's just you're going to have to make things up as you go along sometimes, right? Fabiana, I mean, what are you expecting and how are you preparing mentally for this?
So it's we don't really have room for improvisation, at least in my sector of like the volunteers. We're usually very steady with it. We have our numbers, we have their task of what they're going to do. It just becomes more of a case of if volunteers don't show up, if they come in with the wrong attire, and we kind of just have to either steer them somewhere else or unfortunately send them home if that's the case, just because they are not fitting into the requirement that we need for that specific event.
Because look, the other thing too is this, it's you can't really enjoy it. You're working.
100%.
As you said, you're about to graduate soon. What's in the future, at least the near future for you? What would be the ultimate situation for you?
If I'm honest with you, I love events, but as I've been participating in this graduate program, I've learned more of the business side of things. And I kind of enjoy marketing. I enjoy PR. So I enjoy everything to gear up for like the hospitality world, the events. So I'm not limiting myself to events per se. I would love to gear towards that, but I'm very open to everything. And this hospitality program has definitely helped me out with that.
I mean, Dean Chang, you've had the chance to be through a part of many of these. For someone who's never been part of the South Beach Wine and Food Festival, what do you tell people about what to expect?
My advice would be to do everything in moderation. There's you can easily go overboard with all the drinks and all the food. And you feel like you don't want to miss out on anything, so you try everything. But you just do it in moderation.
That was Dean Michael Chang of the FIU Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management. We also spoke with Fabiana Gutierrez, a graduate student in the program. The South Beach Wine and Food Festival kicked off last night, and there are events happening through the weekend. You can see photos and find more information about the festival by going to WLRN.org. Well, still to come, we hear the sounds of Puerto Rican singer Ile, who's in South Florida for a concert and televised awards ceremony. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. That's Tu Rumba, a new single by Puerto Rican singer Ile. She was 16 years old when she started her professional musical career. The singer rose to fame when she joined her brothers and became part of the hip-hop group Calle 13. Now, she's solo. Ile has a very different sound from her siblings. Think boleros, folk, and Afro-Caribbean beats. Her album, Almadura, was nominated for a 2020 Grammy. Ile will be performing at the North Beach Bandshell in Miami Beach on February 21st, and you can also catch her on Univision tonight at 7 p.m. for Premio Lo Nuestro, a music award show. You're Boricua. You're from Puerto Rico. But what does it mean for you to be Boricua? How do you define that?
I admire many things about our culture and our way of being, but I think that there's something about us that I love, that is that we are very resilient, and there is something about us that for me is admirable, the way we channel things in a way that it seems as if we're not suffering or feeling any pain at all. And for me, I've learned to appreciate that, because a lot of people in Puerto Rico struggle a lot. And for me, it's amazing to see them smile every day. And you meet a lot of people and it seems like they don't have any troubles or anything at all. And then you start talking with them and there's a lot of difficult situations that you would never imagine. And the way we just deal with our surroundings, for me, and I know that music has a lot to do with it as well. We channel a lot of our emotions through music in the streets, and for me, it's admirable. I don't think I've seen that in another place.
What were you listening to when you were young?
In my house, there was always a lot of different music. I'm the little one from that house, so I like absorbed that musical library from my dad, my mom, my brothers and sisters, and there was a lot of salsa, boleros, but at the same time there was rock, jazz, and trova. Obviously, I mean, salsa was always like the base of everything.
And when did you start singing?
I remember enjoying singing since I was like very little, like, I don't know, like 2 years old maybe. My mom tells me that my grandmother, when she took care of me when I was a baby, she used to sing to me. So I don't know if maybe it comes from that. I don't know. There is something that I've always felt that I was going to be in music. I didn't know how exactly, but I've never thought about anything else.
So then you start working with your brothers. First of all, tell us about, you know, how that happened. How did you end up in Calle 13? And what, you know, what that was like at the beginning for you?
It was very normal. I mean, older brothers at the end. I mean, one of them picked me up at school one day and just told me to, I didn't know where he was taking me, but then he was taking me to my other brother's house. And he was putting me a song, and he told me to sing the chorus in with different voices, because at that time I enjoy imitating other voices, and that's how I started like singing, you know, imitating everything that I was listening to. And then at the end he told me like, try to sing it like you, and I didn't know how to do that. I was so confused. I didn't know where he was going and what was all this about. And then suddenly we arrived to my brother's house, and he said to me like, sing the chorus that I just told you in the car. And I recorded it. I didn't know what they were doing, you know. One thing led to another and everything escalated very quickly.
You think about the music they were making and the music you make, and there's this big difference. You break out and you start seeking your own thing. How would you describe to people what your style is?
I always try to say like it has obviously like a Caribbean base to it, but at the same time I try to make it as contemporary as I can, even though I really love, like, I don't want to say old, but that's the only word that comes to mind, but like more old school music. So I really enjoy the variety of sounds and rhythms, especially from the Caribbean.
And you speak of your culture, and it's such an important part of, you know, the stories that you tell in your music. And you look at what's happened over the last few years, especially, I mean, the issue of statehood is a big part of the conversation in Puerto Rico. And, you know, the lack of the federal help that's not come after the hurricanes and now the earthquakes. Let's talk about the album Almadura and how it tackles these ideas. Tell us about the song Odio.
It's basically a song that speaks about the hate that we're living in. But from my personal perspective, I was very angry at the moment that I was writing the song, not only about what you see outside, you know, but when you read the news, when you see social media, like, it's almost as if we are promoting hate to get more ratings or whatever. Like, if the highlight or the headliner of any news is as bad as it can be, like, it's better for the audience.
Let's hear a little bit of it.
Que el odio se muera de hambre porque nadie le da de comer. Vamos juntos a romper muros, barreras y alambres. Que el odio se muera de hambre porque nadie le da de comer. Vamos juntos a romper muros, barreras y alambres.
Ely's album Almadura was nominated for a 2020 Grammy in the Best Rock, Urban, or Alternative Album category, and she's been featured on NPR's Tiny Desk. Her most recent single, Durumba, it explores the central dances within the bomba music community, an integral element of Afro-Puerto Rican traditions. She'll be performing at the North Beach Bandshell in Miami Beach on February 21st. One of the things I find really interesting, too, is, you know, you talk about anger, and you talk about earlier, though, how Puerto Ricans, Boricuas, handle all that anger and stress, and it could still keep a smile on their face. But Puerto Ricans have this fascinating history. I mean, it's a colony. It's a territory. And so Puerto Ricans never really had true freedom. They've never really experienced it. How do you see that in everyday life? How do Puerto Ricans deal with that?
I almost see it like something very psychological. It depends a lot of how much we trust in ourselves and how much we believe in what we can do. We have been so manipulated by this system that we have a colonial state of mind in our way of being, and we don't trust enough in what we can do and how much we can do on our own, because we think that we are incapable and we're not good enough and we're less. And that treatment has a lot to do with abuse, you know? You tend to get accustomed to receiving abuse that you start to believe in that.
What do you think has changed, though, over the last few years? Two hurricanes, the earthquakes, the protest, they threw out their governor. Is something changing?
Yes, there is definitely something very magnificent happening for me. I've been waiting for this all my life. Just this, something that just clicks. And the thing is that in Puerto Rico, things have to be very strong enough for us to react. But at the end, for me, the important thing is for us to get out of our houses and go to the streets. That's what we should do. At the end, it doesn't matter necessarily about the status right now. It matters a lot about our self-esteem and how we can, and the message that we want to send to the government.
You know, you mentioned it a couple of times, this idea of this emotional abuse. And this is a theme that comes out throughout your music, like the song Rescatarme, or Rescue Me. Let's hear a little bit of it. One more topic that you also like to talk about, which is sexuality. Kind of help me understand that idea of the Puerto Rican mentality towards sexuality and how that culture handles sexuality, handles itself that way.
Puerto Rico is tough because, I mean, there's always a fine line in everything. And I think sexuality is one of them, because one thing is embracing what you are, your body, loving yourself, and not caring so much about taboos from society and other things. But at the same time, there is a fine line in between other things, you know, when it comes to sexuality. Since we are a small island, we have to be careful, I think, with our children as well, and how children perceive what sexuality is, which for me is something beautiful, but like people can perceive it as something vulgar.
I wanted to ask you about the song Durumba, because it kind of touches on that, you know, the issues of sexuality. But tell me a little bit about that song and what you're saying.
Well, Durumba is the most flirty song of the album, I think, which I enjoy. I explore indirectly with the bomba puertorriqueña, and inside the bomba there's a lot of different rhythms, and they all have their different languages and ways of speaking in the movements and in the sounds as well. And this rhythm that I played with in this song is called Cuembe. And the cuembe rhythm is very sensual and very flirty as well, and the body language is very sensual, and I like that a lot. I love bomba, and I love how we speak through it. And in this song, I really just, since it's about connecting with other people without any fear at all, you know, I wanted it to be very direct and aggressive at the same time, like bomba is.
Give me a little taste of that.
Yo no sé si es el rabito de tus ojos que está buscando encontrarse con lo mío, pero siento que hay un algo tuyo que me llama entre medio de tanto gentío. Hermosura que sale de ti va flotando hasta llegar a mí. No sé si tu rumba vaya con mi mambo, pero tú tienes lo que estoy necesitando. No sé si tu rumba vaya con mi mambo, pero tienes lo que estoy necesitando.
And that was Puerto Rican singer Ile. She is going to be performing at the North Beach Bandshell in Miami Beach on February 21st. You can find more information at WLRN.org. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, February 20th. Coming up next week on Sundial, we're going to continue our conversations about new bills in Tallahassee as the legislative session continues. Plus, what can dinosaurs teach children about the impact of climate change? Oh, we're going to talk about dinosaurs next week. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Have a great Friday, a great weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.